Amen.
Okay, we are in the tractate, or not the tractate, but the portion called Pinchas. You might be familiar with this portion. This is the portion, it begins, or it includes the story of Pinchas and his zeal. It is a controversial portion because Pinchas is so zealous on God's behalf that he acts in a way so as to summarily execute someone in the community who has committed idolatry before the eyes of the entire community. And it so infuriated him that he takes a spear and he kills the man and the woman together. Of course, the backstory is that Balak, the king of Moab, asked Balaam, the prophet, to curse Israel, and he couldn't. But what he does do is tell Balak how to bring God's curse upon his own people, and he tells him to entice the people of Israel to engage in idolatry, and that will bring God's curse upon them. And so he does, and it does, right? So the story is a difficult story. We learn about it not only from this portion and from the end of the previous portion in the book of Numbers, but from another passage in the Torah as well. And of course, Balaam, as a prophet who was interested only in his own good, is mentioned a couple of times in the apostolic writings as well. I have talked about Pinchas on several occasions, so if you are interested in kind of a discussion about Pinchas specifically, then please take advantage of one of our previous studies. This time I want to talk about something else. So we're going to pick up the story in chapter 26, after the plague, because the Lord brings a plague against his people. 24,000 die in the plague. And so this story in chapter 26 now picks up after the plague. The Lord said to Moses and Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, take a census of the whole Israelite community by families, all those 20 years old or more who are able to serve in the army of Israel. So, there is a census taken in the beginning of the book of Numbers, and this is the second census, the census taken at the end of the book of Numbers. The first census was taken as the people of Israel enter the wilderness, and this census is taken as they prepare to go into the promised land. So there is approximately 38 to 40 years separation between these two censuses. Okay? So in verse 3, on the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, Moses and Eleazar the priest spoke with them and said, take a census of the men 20 years old or more, as the Lord commanded Moses, and these were the Israelites who came out of Egypt. Okay? In verse 5, it goes on to mention, the descendants of Reuben, the firstborn son of Israel, were through Hanok and the Hanokite clan, through Palu, and it mentions the descendants of Reuben, and how large the clan of Reuben or the tribe of Reuben was at the time of this census, 43,730. And it's interesting, which is something we have done in the past, to compare the size of the tribes after the 40-year wandering in the wilderness to the size of the tribe before. Some of the tribes get larger, some of the tribes get smaller. At any rate, it goes on in verse 8, the son of Palu was Eliab, and the sons of Eliab were Nemuel, Dathan, and Aviram, or Datan and Aviram. And you probably remember Datan and Aviram because they were the community officials who rebelled against Moses and Aaron and were among the followers of Korach earlier when Korach and that great company of 250 community leaders rebel against the authority of Moses and Aaron. And of course, it is considered to be a rebellion against the Lord as well, here in verse 9. And then it goes on in verse 10 to say, the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them along with Korach, whose followers died when the fire devoured the 250 men. And they served as a warning sign. But notice what it says in verse 11. And this is something that we're going to talk about a little bit. The line of Korach, however, did not die out. Okay? This is an important, important statement because we are introduced to the sons of Korach several times. So Rashi, a well-known rabbi who lived in the 11th and early 12th century, observes that the sons of Korach, they were part of the original conspiracy, but relented at the time of the actual confrontation. So in other words, when Korach first put his company of leading community people together to confront Moses and Aaron, that the sons of Korach, according to Rashi, were also influenced to participate in this revolt. But prior to the time of the actual confrontation, they withdraw. They back out. Accordingly, their punishment in the world to come was reduced. Korach, according to Exodus chapter 6, had three sons who constituted the family of the Korachites, named later. Their descendants are mentioned several times in the book of Chronicles. And what's really interesting is that 11 psalms are attributed to them. So, you are no doubt familiar with the book of Psalms and with all of the psalms that are attributed to King David. But some psalms are attributed to other authors. And as it turns out, 11 psalms are attributed to the sons of Korach. According to a tradition, one of the psalms deals with their miraculous rescue, which we will talk about in Psalm 42. Okay, so if you look in your notes, it goes on to talk about Exodus chapter 6, which mentions the names of the sons of Levi according to their records. The Korach, of course, was a Levite, and therefore his sons were obviously Levites. But it talks about the three Levitical families: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. It says that Levi lived 137 years. And then it talks about the sons of Gershon by clans, the sons of Kohath by clans, and the sons of Merari by clans. Notice in verse 20, though, it says, Amram married his father's sister, Jochebed, who bore him Aaron and Moses. Now, this is a bit unusual as well because it introduces the name of one of the people's wives, which is not something that is often included in genealogies. And you can read genealogies in the book of Chronicles. There are many places in the Bible where genealogies are mentioned. And on occasion, you find the name of one of the individual's wives mentioned, but it's not done all that frequently. So when it is done, it's important, and the woman is important for the record. Okay? At any rate, Jochebed bore Aaron and Moses. Amram also lived 137 years. It goes on to talk about the sons of Izhar, that they are Korach and Nepheg and Zikri. The sons of Uziel were Mishael, Elzaphan and Zithi, and then it talks about more about the sons. But notice it talks about the sons of Korach in verse 24. By the way, the word Korach, the name Korach, means bald. Okay? His first son was Asir, which means bound. In some, it could also be translated captive. It seems like an odd name to give a son, the name captive or bound, but we don't really know what context prompted him to give his son this name. But if you look at the name of his second son, Elkanah means God has created, and Aviasaph means my father has gathered. So he names his sons names which are pretty typical of the names that people in biblical times gave their children, names that reflected their relationship with God, their faith in God, their hope in God, their view that God created all things and was the provider of all things. At any rate, Eleazar, the son of Aaron, married one of the daughters of Petuel, and she bore him Pinchas, who is the subject of the earlier chapter in this section, the one who had great zeal, and God makes with him a covenant of peace. In other words, he ratifies or reaffirms the covenant that he makes with Aaron to Pinchas, and it's referred to in chapter 25 as a covenant of peace. At any rate, let's continue and look at this passage in the book of Numbers. Korach, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohat, the son of Levi, and certain Reubenites, Datan and Aviram, they rebel against the authority of Moses here in this passage in Numbers chapter 16. Okay? And, of course, they confront them with the question, why do you set yourselves above the Lord's community? And, of course, they were from the tribe of Levi as well, and obviously felt that they could do a better job than Moses was doing, even though God is the one who raises up Moses and Aaron to lead the community, and he affirms this on several occasions. Okay? So, this is the passage in number 16 where this resurrection takes place, and of course, the earth opens its mouth. A very typical description of an event in Hebrew. It anthropomorphizes the earth like it does God, like it does angels, like it does animals, and gives them human emotions and human qualities and characteristics. So the earth opens its mouth and swallows them, and they go right to the grave, right to Sheol. Now, the sons of Kohat or Korach are not mentioned here, but it is assumed that they are involved in this revolt, but they back out before it occurs. And so this is one of the psalms that is regarded as a psalm which speaks of the way God rescues them. Okay? So if you look at Psalm 42, for the director of music, a maskil, which is a poem or a song of the sons of Korach. And it's interesting because this first verse you may have on occasion attributed to David, but it actually was written by the sons of Korach. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with God? My tears have been my food day and night, while people say to me all day long, where is your God? These things I remember as I pour out my soul. how I used to go to the house of God under the protection of the Mighty One with shouts of joy and praise among the festive throng. Why, my soul, are you downcast? Why so disturbed within me? Right? So, according to some of the rabbis or some of the sages, this psalm was written to speak of the way God rescues the sons of Korach from their impending demise as members of Korach's company, right? So they withdraw their support from Korach's rebellion, right? And apparently just in time. So they rethink what their father Korach is doing and decide that among themselves that he is not doing the right thing, and that these other people, these other leading members of the community, are not doing the right thing either. Right? So they are swallowed up by the earth, and the sons of Korach are preserved. And the psalm ends with this passage in verse 11. Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise Him, my Savior and my God. Okay? Now, the reason why this touched a chord with me on this occasion, not only because I have talked about Pinchas so often in the past, but because of a passage in the book of Ezekiel. If you look at this passage in Ezekiel chapter 18, it's a lengthy passage. I'm going to abbreviate it. But it says, the word of the Lord came to me in verse 1. What do you people mean by quoting this proverb about the land of Israel? The parents eat sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. Okay? That's a proverb that existed in Israel at the time. And frankly, it's a proverb which reflects the notion or the idea that what parents do affects their children, right? Notice it's the parents who eat the sour grapes, but the children's teeth that are set on edge. And if you have ever eaten a sour grape, or if you have ever had to drink something that was bitter, right, like a medicine or something else, you drink it, and you probably still remember it because it made you go like, ooh, right? That's the reaction you have. And of course, your children don't have that reaction because they didn't taste it, right? I remember my kids sent me a picture of my grandson once who bit into an onion. He bites into an onion like he would an apple, and he makes that face. It's like, I can still remember it in the picture, but the funny thing is, as soon as he chews up and swallows that piece of onion, he takes another bite. Right? But when the parents eat sour grapes, it doesn't set the children's teeth on edge. It sets their teeth on edge. But the proverb is intended to communicate this notion or idea that what parents do does reflect on their children and have an impact in the lives of their children. That's what the passage in the Torah speaks of when it speaks about God visits the sin of the parents on the third and fourth generations. They're not responsible for their parents' sin, but they are certainly impacted by their parents' sin. But this passage goes on to say, as surely as I live, declares the Sovereign Lord, you will no longer quote this proverb in Israel, because it had come to mean that the children are responsible for the sins of their parents, which they are not. Children are not responsible for the sins of their parents. For everyone belongs to me, the Lord says, the parent as well as the child, both alike belong to me. The one who sins is the one who will die. Suppose there is a righteous man who does what is just and right. He follows my decrees and faithfully keeps my laws. That man is righteous. He will surely live, declares the sovereign Lord. Suppose he has a violent son who sheds blood or does any of these other things, though the father has done none of them, right? In other words, he does all of the things that his father doesn't. He lends interest and takes profit. Will such a man live? He will not. Because he has not done all these detestable things, he is to be put to death. His blood will be on his own head. But suppose this son has a son who sees all the sins his father commits, and though he sees them, he does not do such thing, right? Because he does see them. He doesn't do those things. He keeps my laws and follows my decrees. He will not die for his father's sons. He will surely live, right? His father will die for his own sin, but the son who takes it upon himself to walk in a way different from his father will live, right? And I think this passage is important because we live in a time just like that was true in Israel during the days of Ezekiel, when we assume oftentimes that children grow up like their parents, right? And that is often true, obviously, for the good or for the bad. But the fact of the matter is that children, they don't have to be like their parents. Unless, of course, their parents set a good example, then it is good for them to be like the good example that their parents, made for them. But the fact of the matter is that many of us have struggled in life for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the difficult relationship that we may have had with a mother or a father or both parents, right? And we struggle with coming to terms with the impact of their values and their parental skills on our lives, right? And in some cases, we make a decision at a very young age not to be like our parents, right? In some cases, we don't make that kind of decision, but the fact of the matter is that we are capable of doing that, right? We are capable of not walking in the ways of our parents if those ways were not particularly healthy ones. It is possible for us to learn from their mistakes without us having to make the same ones, right? And so, this lesson, in my opinion, is incredibly, incredibly important because it means that we can break the cycle of abuse or the cycle of violence or the cycle of bad parenting or the cycle of fill in the blank, right? It obviously depends upon the way you were impacted and the way I was impacted by my parents, the way they raised their children, or the way your parents raised you, right? And of course, it's always a mixed bag, right? Obviously, our parents did the best job they could under the circumstances, right? In some cases, that is not true. But in most cases, right, parents do the best job they can, They just were not equipped to be good parents. And in many cases, they were not. Thank God for those of you who had good parents, right? And for many of us, we found it more easy to relate to one of our parents than the other. But regardless of the mix, at some point, we reach an age at which we are accountable to God for our own behavior. And like the sons of Korach, we can make a decision to break with the infidelity of a parent, to break with the mistakes of a parent, right? To break with the practices of a parent or the inappropriate assumptions of a parent. We can break with the lies, I guess, is what I'm saying. And it is possible to break the lies in your life, just like the sons of Korach did. And they go on, the sons of Korach go on, you know, to be solid members of the community, and in some cases to be the author of these beautiful psalms that we still find solace in, right? So their relationship with God was repaired because they saw what their father was doing and decided against doing that in their own lives, right? It's an incredibly important lesson, in my opinion, because it means that we have the capacity, with God's help, right, to put an end or to put a stop to I wish I could think of a better word, to put a stop to the mishagas, right? It's a Yiddish word which means, well, it sometimes means nonsense, right? The nonsense and the calamity that we live with because of the things that were said about us or said to us. With God's help, we have the ability to rise above it, right? And to make a different life for ourselves than our parents did. Okay? At any rate, this passage goes on to say, yet you ask in verse 19, why does the son not share the guilt of the father? Since the son has done what is just and right and has been careful to keep all of my decrees, he will surely live. And then it goes on to conclude, the one who sins is the one who dies. The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child. Right? Because obviously it works with children too. There are occasions when a child goes very, very wrongly bad, even though they were raised in a home in which you would not expect that from a child, right? So it sometimes works both ways. But this goes on to say, the child will not share the guilt of a parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child. The righteousness of the righteous will be credited to them, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against them, right? So we are all ultimately responsible for our own behavior. So it makes a great deal of sense to look at our lives and our upbringing and our parenting skills if we have children, and look at them as objectively as possible and try to learn whatever lessons we can, right, for the good or for the bad, from our parents and and based also obviously on what we see going on in the lives of our children, and then make whatever accommodation is required to change. Now, obviously, it's very easy to say those words and very difficult to do it, but based upon what we learn in the Torah about the sons of Korach, it's possible. If it was possible for them, it's possible for us, right? Something else which is interesting is that according to Rashi, their punishment in the world to come was reduced. And it reminded me of a passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation, Paul says, as a wise builder, and someone else is building upon it. But each one should build with care. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one that has already been laid, which is Yeshua the Messiah. If anyone builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, their work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each person's work. Right? Now, what made me think of this passage was this reference to an individual's work being tested by fire. Now, Paul in this passage does not say what the fire is or when the fire comes. Right? Many people would say, well, we are tested in this life as we live our lives. And we experience good things, and we experience difficult things. We experience traumatic things, right? Now, you probably have learned, if you have experienced traumatic things, that trauma has the ability, right, to generate newfound faith in our lives and a new confidence in God and a refreshing of a relationship with God, or it can hurt us and debilitate us, right? I mean, it can often do one or the other, and it's kind of a remarkable thing to see how it affects people. And so many of us would think of difficult experiences that we have experienced as a kind of testing by fire, a fire that reveals what it is that we are really made of and what we have built on the foundation of the Messiah in our lives. Whether it is gold, silver, and costly stones, or whether it is wood, hay, and stubble. Right now, gold, silver, and costly stones are refined by fire, and wood, hay, and straw, or stubble, are consumed by fire. Right? So what we do in our lives is an important part of how we grow to maturity and how we experience this fire in our lives. And some would say that the fire comes later, right? That there is a refining process in the Olam Haba, and that the dross or the straw is burned away, and the gold and the silver and the costly stones are what are preserved and become the basis of our reward in the Olam Haba. Because Paul goes on in verse 14 to say, if what has been built survives, the builder will receive a reward. But the reward is in the Olam Haba, in the world to come. If it is burned up, the builder will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, even though only as one escaping through the flames. Okay? And then there is a passage in the book of Revelation which speaks of this as well. This is towards the end of the book of Revelation. In chapter 20, verse 11, then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. The earth and the heavens fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. The books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged, notice, according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. Right? The various books that God opens on Judgment Day. Now, obviously, this does not necessarily mean that there are actual books, but it does mean that God is aware of everything that goes on in our lives. The sea gives up the dead that are in it. Death and Sheol give up the dead that are in them, and each person is judged according to what they had done. Right? By the way, this is echoed in Matthew 24 and 25, too. In the words of Yeshua, when Yeshua separates the sheep and the goats, what is that separation based on? What they did. Right? When you saw me hungry, you fed me. When you saw me naked, you clothed me. When you saw that I was in prison, you visited me. Right? So, the judgment, according to these passages, has to do with what we do. Of course, if you look at the book of James, you would recognize or understand that in Jewish thought, faith is what motivates deeds. We do what we do because of our faith, because we trust God, because we're committed to the Lord. So, in Jewish thought, those things go together. At any rate, these notions are important because as long as we are alive, we have the ability to change. We have the ability to have an impact in the lives of others. We can do something with our lives, right? It is often said, and I know that this is the way many of us feel, I'm only one person. What can I do? What can I really do? But the fact of the matter is that that's all it often takes to have an impact in the lives of another individual or in the life of a community or in the life of a nation. I mean, frankly, if you think back through history and look in the Bible, you will see that many individuals had a great impact in the lives of others. And why should not that be true of you, right? Or me, right? Why shouldn't that be true of any one of us? The fact is that we are called to be faithful with whatever gifts and abilities and talents we have been given, and we have been called to have an impact, a benevolent or beneficial impact in the lives of others, right? So that is something that we can all do, regardless of who we are, where we live, where we work, right? That's something we can all do. And these are the things that make us who we are. At any rate, let's move on. I do want to say a couple of things about Jochebed. In chapter 26, verse 5, it speaks about the Levites, and I mentioned earlier as we read this section, the name of Amram's wife was Jochebed, a descendant of Levi, who was born to the Levites in Egypt. So here we are provided some background on Jochebed that is interesting, but you have to wonder why It's included, right? So it's obviously included, at least in Jewish thought, because it wants you to stop. As I have mentioned many times, Hebrew doesn't have vowels. It only has consonants. And the way it is written, there are no capital letters. It is difficult to tell where sentences begin and end. There are no italics. You can't highlight a text. You can't put it in bold print. You can't make it red or blue or green like I do in my notes. There is absolutely no way to highlight it except to say something unusual or to put words in the improper order or to mix up the order of the words. Like in the Ten Commandments when it says to honor one's father and mother, right? But when that commandment is repeated in the book of Deuteronomy, it says to honor one's mother and one's father. It puts the mother first. So, when you come across a passage like that, it makes you stop. At least a Hebrew reader, it makes them stop and contemplate the significance of the text. So here, we are reading the names of men who became the fathers of their sons and daughters, right? But the text causes us to break. Abraham's wife was Jochebed. She was a descendant of Levi, who was born to the Levites in Egypt, which is interesting because the implication is that she was not conceived in Egypt, but born in Egypt, okay? And then it goes on to talk about the sons of Amram, okay? But let's look at the note. Jochebed was not conceived in Egypt, and so was counted among the 70 who went down to Egypt in Exodus chapter 1, verse 5, even though she was not explicitly listed, which means, by definition, what? According to Rashi, that Jochebed was a person in the womb, right? And she was counted as a person in the womb and counted as one of those in Jacob's company who descended to Egypt because she was born in Egypt after Jacob and his family got there. Okay? That's one observation. Another is that this woman had an exceptional destiny. It is not surprising to find her at the heart of this genealogy. She married her nephew Amram, which was legitimate only because the Torah had not yet been given. When Pharaoh decreed that newborn Jewish males were to be killed, according to the Midrash, not according to the Bible, but according to the Midrash, her husband divorced her, although she was 3 months pregnant with Moses, okay? But her daughter Miriam, Moses' older sister, already inspired by the divine spirit, insisted that her husband take her back. So according to the Midrash, when Pharaoh's decree went forth to kill all of the male children that were born of Jewish couples in Egypt or Israelite couples in Egypt, right? It was said in the Midrash that many husbands divorced their wives in order to prevent them from bearing children, right? Because then they wouldn't have kids because they weren't married. They wouldn't have kids. So it would avoid the slaughter of these innocent male children. Okay? But Miriam went to her father Amram and said, "What about daughters? Right? What about us? I mean, there's no decree against killing females, right?" So her father Amram was persuaded by her argument, and the men in the community remarried their wives, and they continued to have sons and daughters, right? Some of the sons were sacrificed. I mean, obviously they fell under Pharaoh's edict, right? But the daughters did not. But again, the Midrash, it is not a biblical text. The Midrash is designed to help us appreciate that daughters are just as valuable as sons. That was the point of the Midrash, right? It's a story to make a point that daughters are valuable as well. At any rate, it goes on to say, this would ensure that the child she was expecting not come into the world as a child of a broken home. So there were issues with broken homes in biblical days as well. Yocheved knew all the tribulations of parenthood. Alas, she outlived all her children and died at the age, according to the Midrash, another Midrash, of 250. And this is from a Midrash called Seder Olam, which, interestingly enough, there is a greater Seder Olam and a lesser Seder Olam, and there it is designed to put creation in some type of chronology. Okay? Because it's interesting because Jewish literature is not particularly concerned with chronology, but here's an exception. At any rate, shortly after Moses' death, but she had the satisfaction of entering the promised land. So she dies after Moses, but she had the satisfaction of entering the promised land. She had the merit, the great merit of founding dynasties of Kohanim, of priests, and kings. In the book of Exodus, we read that Hashem bestowed these prerogatives upon her because of her devotion to her people when she and her daughter Miriam served so courageously as midwives at the time of Pharaoh's barbarous decrees. And of course, you're familiar with the fact that Miriam watched Pharaoh's daughter rescue Moses from the river, right? And when she was, and then she suggested, should I find someone who can nurse this baby for you? Miriam arranges for the woman who nurses Moses through his years of weaning to his mother. Right? So Miriam, makes sure that Yocheved is the woman who weans Moses. And of course, it is during that time that she inculcates certain values and principles into him that last him his entire life. Okay? Now, what's interesting about this is that we find the same comments made in the genealogy of Yeshua in Matthew 1. This is the genealogy of Yeshua the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah. But notice it goes on to say, whose mother was Tamar. Right? So it breaks with the typical order of a genealogy, and it indicates that the mother of Perez and Zerah was Tamar. Perez, as it turns out, is a very important person in the genealogy of the Messiah because it was said of him that his descendant would restore order to the world. Right? We've talked about this several times too. That's why the story of Judah and Tamar occurs almost as a parenthesis in the story of Joseph and his brothers in the book of Judah. And many people wonder what it is even doing there, because the story is being told of Joseph, his brothers, their hatred, right? He's sold into slavery. He goes to prison. He spends years in prison. Right? That whole story, it's a remarkable story. But in the middle of it is the story about Judah and Tamar, which doesn't seem to have any place in the narration, except that it's a story about the one who will ultimately come and redeem not only God's people, but provide salvation for the entire world, right? So Tamar is very important. It goes on to talk about Salmon, who is the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, right? So it talks about Rahab in this passage. Boaz is the father of Obed, but it goes on to say whose mother was Ruth, right? And then it goes on to talk about Solomon and said whose mother, now this is a very indirect way in the text of recognizing Bathsheba, whose mother had been Uriah's wife, right? So, everybody knows it's Bathsheba, but Matthew doesn't call her Bathsheba, right? She is Uriah's wife. Wife formerly is Uriah's wife. But the inclusion of these four women in the genealogy of the Messiah for Matthew is very, very important. Now, I would guess, please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I would guess that on the occasions when you have read the genealogy of the Messiah in the Gospel of Matthew, that you have ignored the presence of these four women in the genealogy. You read over them. The fact of the matter is that each of these four women have very significant midrashim associated with them. In other words, the rabbis have talked a great deal about these four women, and they attach great significance, great redemptive significance to these four women, and that is obviously why Matthew includes them in the genealogy of Yeshua in his gospel, right? Because he wants the impact of all of this redemptive implication connected to the genealogy of the Messiah. That's why Matthew arranges the genealogy the way he does, right? We are going to be talking about that, by the way, in the next chapter, chapter 9 of the Messiah series on Thursday night. After we finish our current chapter, the next chapter is the genealogy of the Messiah, and this is something we are going to talk about in a great bit of detail. Okay? At any rate, and then, of course, the fifth woman in the genealogy of the Messiah is Mary, right? Mary, who was the mother of Yeshua, who is called the Messiah. Let's talk briefly about the daughters of Zelophehad. We are running out of time. You're familiar with the daughters of Zelophehad. The nation is preparing to go into the land, and the land is going to be divided among the tribes of Israel. Okay? When the decree is issued regarding how the land is to be divided, the daughters of Zelophehad object because their father died in the desert and he had no sons, right? So his inheritance, there was no one for it to go to. So the daughters of Zelophehad go through the process of appealing to the judicial order that is established earlier in the Torah, right, where there are judges over 10, over 100, over 1,000, right? And so they go through the judicial process, and no one is willing to rule in their case, and they take the case to Moses. And Moses, of course, is unwilling to rule in their case as well, and so he takes the case to God, and God says they're right. These women are right. Listen to them. Because their father had no sons does not mean that they should not receive his inheritance in the land, right? So, What's important about the story is what they say in verse 27, verse 4. Why should our father's name disappear from his clan? Because he had no son. Give us property among our father's relatives. And so that is the way God rules. And it is made, if you notice in verse 11, a legal requirement for the Israelites. It's made a mishpat, a judgment, right? The daughters of Zelophehad, if you look in your notes, were motivated to seek justice by their confidence that Hashem's love is not like a father's love. And, of course, we tend to put a great deal of emphasis on a father's love. But notice, a father may prefer his sons to his daughters. But that is not true of God. The Creator loves us all equally. His mercy extends to all creatures. And so in this next section, I have a couple of examples of cases where a father shows favoritism. In the case of Joseph, one son over his others, right? And of course, favoritism is something that we talk about as parents, and we recognize that favoritism is not a good thing. But the fact of the matter is that it's very natural, and you have to kind of work against it, right? You have to, it sometimes requires an effort to treat all of your children in the same way, to treat your daughters as you treat your sons, because it's just an inclination, I guess, that sometimes men prefer sons to daughters. But that is not true of God. Okay? It is not true of God. God cherishes us all in the same way. It doesn't matter to God whether you are Jewish or not Jewish, whether you are a male or a female. It doesn't matter to God because He has called us all into a connective relationship with Him, right? So God is a father. He is supposed to be the model of what a father's love is like, right? But of course, our efforts often fall short of that example that God provides. But the fact is that the daughters of Zelophehad had confidence that God cherished daughters as much as He cherished sons, right? So there are several passages in this section that speak of the fact that God doesn't show partiality. God does not show favoritism. And because God does not show favoritism, we shouldn't either, right? Either as parents or as people generally. And then finally, this last section, which I will not have the opportunity to talk about, has to do with the death of Moses. Moses is told in this section that he is going to die without entering the land. He is going to get to see it, but he is not going to enter it. And he is promised, though, that he will be gathered to his people. And then there are examples in this next section of many people who were told that they would be gathered to their people. Aaron, Moses in Deuteronomy 32, Abraham, Isaac, and the fact that they are told they are gathered to their people, according to the sages, implies an afterlife, right? Because it is sometimes said that the Bible rarely speaks of an afterlife. But according to the rabbis, each of the occasions when it is said of a leader that when they die, they will be gathered to their people, that means that they will be gathered to their people in Sheol, but alive. Right? Their body may be dead, but their soul, their spirit is gathered to a place that in biblical times was known as Abraham's bosom, right? Or paradise. And of course, that expression, Abraham's bosom, appears in the story that Yeshua tells in Luke chapter 16 about the rich man who descends to Sheol, right, and his encounter or exchange with a beggar named Lazarus, who is in Abraham's bosom, right? So this next section deals with this concept or this idea. The fact is, when we die, we don't die, just our bodies. Our bodies go to sleep, right? And of course, they appear to be sleeping because they're inactive. But that does not mean that our soul, our spirit, our inner being, it is not inactive. It is, well, now it is with the Lord. In biblical times, the inner man of the righteous would have gone to paradise or would have gone to Abraham's bosom, right? And the wicked would have gone somewhere else, right? When the Messiah came, he took all of those who were in Abraham's bosom, he took them to the presence of the Lord, so that they are with the Lord now in his presence. At any rate, there are a couple of other things that I talk about in this section too, but we're out of time. So, I will defer them for a future study. Okay? You know, years ago, when I was teaching, I'd have so much material I never finished it. I always started at the beginning and never got to the end. So Dolores told me one time, she said, you know, one of these years you should just start the notes from the other end. Start from the end and work backwards, and maybe you'll catch up to the section in the middle where you left off the first time, right? It was a good suggestion. Maybe I'll do that one of these years. At any rate, we're done for the day unless you have any comments or questions. Anybody?
Hopefully it won't be too lengthy because I don't want to take up anybody's time. But this teaching has been very impactful in a sense where from a Hebraic and from a Jewish perspective that women and girls and daughters are valued. From my culture, boys are highly, highly valued. In China, there was a period of time where they would get rid of baby girls. They would, you know, there was a period, I think it was in the 90s, and it was just the one, you know, and they only had a one-kid policy.
I remember.
Yeah, if they didn't have that boy, then you know, so there were like orphanages of baby girls, and even though I don't know if that's really happening anymore, but like nowadays, like in my generation and in like my cousin's generation, boys are still very much valued. Like in our families, if there is a boy, the boy generally gets better treatment than the girls. But the girls have to do a lot of work. Because girls, for some reason, are more responsible than boys at a younger age. So then we hold more responsibility, but the parents don't love us the same way that they love the boys. And the boys don't do anything. They spoil them. They make all the daughters take care of the boys. And so this, you know, learning about this is just, it's very meaningful. So I just wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because that is a tragic consequence of cultures in which boys are valued over girls. And it's not just true in China. It's true in a lot of places. But the difficult consequence is that girls are sometimes raised in homes where no matter what they do, it is never enough. right? It is never enough to receive their parents' acceptance. Okay? So that happens to be a consequence of this type of parenting, and it's incredibly, incredibly important for girls to appreciate how much God loves them, and it's important to overcome the lie that the favor you receive from God is determined by what you do, right? And I mean, that's true for many of us boys too, right? We also had a very difficult time pleasing a father, right? So it was true for many of us too. But the fact of the matter is that kind of one of those unspoken things that impacts girls, that more is expected of them, but less is given, right? And you have to overcome that in your relationship with God, because with God, you are just as gifted, just as intrinsically valuable, just as precious to God as a boy, just as capable of doing anything. In other words, women can be gifted and have an impact in the lives of others as well, and be used of the Spirit of God in powerful ways too, right? It's just not for men or boys. So I appreciate your comment. Let me look at a couple of others. Bonita said that she did not receive the notes. Bonita, I will make sure you get them. Sorry. Thanks for Joseph, who's just mentioned that he enjoyed the study. Sunflower asks, a few parshas ago, when giving the value of shekels for men, women, children, boys, and girls, why are the values for each different? The values for each are different because in biblical times, a person's value, and I don't mean their intrinsic value, there's a difference between an individual's intrinsic value and their value to the collective or to the community. In biblical times, because the people of Israel lived in an agrarian society, right, men were capable of doing things that women were not, right? Now, I'm an electrician by trade. I have worked in the construction industry my entire adult life. And in 42 years, I have occasionally seen a woman on a construction site, but not very often. And it's not because women are not allowed on construction sites. It mostly has to do with the fact that the strength required to build things is, you know, it's just something that you that is a characteristic, a quality of men, right? Men tend, although not always, men tend to be physically stronger than women. Now, that is not true of all men. It is not true of all women, but it tends to be true. Men are physically stronger than women, right? And frankly, construction requires a great deal of strength because of the tools that we work with require a great deal of strength. Otherwise, you're going to break something or be injured, right? It's just the way it works. So, in biblical times, strength was often what determined one's value, but not intrinsic value. It had nothing to do with their intrinsic value. It had to do with what they were capable of contributing to the farming community, right? Whether or not they could harness two oxen together and plow a field, right? That is something that that was more typically the responsibility of men than it was women. It did not mean that a woman's contribution or a child's contribution wasn't valuable too, but valuable in a different way, and it had nothing to do with their intrinsic value, right? So I hope that answered it. Ed expressed, I appreciate your kind words, Ed. It is definitely relevant and relatable for me specifically regarding the relationships between parents and their children. Thank you. I appreciate you sharing that because it was the lesson was an important one for me too. Mary mentions that it was a very encouraging study. Thank you. And Cassandra as well. I appreciate the feedback. And Wanda as well. But asks the question, when the census was taken and it says of the men 20 or older, were the women included in the census? No, because at the time the census was taken of the men because these were the men who were counted to be a part of the Israeli army, right? So in biblical times, the army was made up of men, which, by the way, has been true of most armies throughout history. That is only different lately. But, by the way, in Israel, modern Israel, women have always served in the modern Israeli army. And, in fact, in Israel, it's a requirement of both men and women that they join the army when they graduate from high school. It is not an option. There is no draft. They are automatically put into the army when they graduate. They're allowed a year off. When a young man or young woman, Israeli young man or young woman, they graduate from high school, they get a year off, and on the anniversary of that graduation, they are required to report for their military service. And every man and every woman in Israel has military training, right? The men serve for longer and for a longer period of time, but all of the women in Israel receive weapons training and military training too, right? So Israel is an armed society. At any rate, that's why the women were not included in the census then, because military service was not required of them at the time. Sunflower says, thanks for the clarification. A good reminder, God created physical differences to embrace and understand, especially for today's time with gender confusion. That's true. Although, as I mentioned, it's not universal. I mean, obviously, there are some women stronger than men, and it's just the strength difference is a tendency, but not a rule, obviously, an absolute. Okay? At any rate, I guess I appreciate your comments and observations. And so with that, I guess I will say Shabbat Shalom. I pray that the Lord would bless the rest of your Sabbath. And Lord willing, I will see you on Thursday night. as we continue our study on the Messiah. And if not, I look forward to seeing you next Shabbat. So thank you for sharing and participating with me and spending this time together. Okay, so may the Lord bless you and be with you. And Lord willing, I will see you next time. God bless you all.